Today is Friday, the second day of October, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. U.S. President Donald Trump and the First Lady have tested positive for COVID-19.
We heard from the White House Chief of Staff, Mark Meadows, that we have a president that is not only on the job, he will remain on the job.
Plus, how technology is helping curb the spread of COVID-19 in Israel.
Shin Bet receives names of confirmed COVID-19 patients from the health ministry and then uses a classified database of phone records.
We'll have these stories and more next. U.S. President Donald Trump has announced that he and the First Lady, Melania Trump, have tested positive for the coronavirus. Steve Herman is VOA's White House bureau chief, and I spoke with him just a short while ago.
Well, the Trump campaign is essentially frozen at this moment. The president was supposed to attend a campaign event in Washington, D.C. at his hotel on Friday afternoon, and then in the evening do a rally in Florida. So both those events obviously canceled. And because the president has tested positive and is in quarantine, we can expect for 10 days, perhaps 2 weeks, that he will not be out on the campaign trail. And Steve, a big question right now is whether the second scheduled presidential debate between Trump and Biden will go ahead.
The president, of course, is the chief executive and has a job to do. So what has the White House and the campaign said about continuing his duties? And if any other preparations have been made, should the president become ill and need to be hospitalized?
Right. Well, we heard from the White House chief of staff, Mark Meadows, just a little while ago, assuring reporters at the White House that we have a president that is not only on the job, he will remain on the job. And Meadows is confirming that the president has mild symptoms. We've also heard that on Twitter now from the First Lady as well. So it would seem as long as the president's condition does not worsen, he can remain doing what he normally does, the main functions of the president, and can receive all sorts of briefings remotely. In fact, he has one scheduled for Friday, a telephone briefing, ironically, about COVID-19 and vulnerable seniors.
Steve, you're part of the White House press radio pool and do get routinely tested when you travel with the president. Now, since this diagnosis has come out, have you had to get extra testing?
Yes, we have the option of getting tested again. Those of us who were on Air Force One on Tuesday or Wednesday with the president, I was on the round trip to and from Minnesota, as a matter of fact, where I noted in my radio pool report that in Duluth at the rally, the president uncharacteristically cut short his remarks, only lasting about 45 minutes. He normally goes an hour and 15. I, however, found myself in a very unique situation as being the only reporter that was shifting between Wednesday and Friday from the Trump campaign on Air Force One to the Biden campaign. I was scheduled on Friday to be traveling with the former vice president, who had scheduled events in Michigan. As is routine, on Thursday evening, the campaign had us take a precautionary COVID test, which in my case was negative. And then when this news about Hope Hicks emerged, I did inform the Biden campaign that I had been on Air Force One. They consulted with their medical team and then decided out of an abundance of caution, it would be best for me not to travel with the Biden campaign on Friday, and I accepted that.
Steve Herman is VOA's White House bureau chief, and since this is a developing story, we'll have updated information in our newscasts and on our website. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma has this report on a growing list of world leaders who have contracted COVID-19.
The president is not alone among world leaders to get COVID-19. Britain's Boris Johnson got sick in April. Then Brazil's president, Jair Bolsonaro, announced his illness in July and used it to publicly extol hydroxychloroquine, the unproven malaria drug that he'd promoted as a treatment for COVID-19 and was taking himself. Another Belarus's Alexander Lukashenko, who dismissed concerns about the virus as psychosis and recommended drinking vodka to stay healthy, said in July he'd contracted it himself, but was asymptomatic. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
Global shares have fallen after President Trump and the First Lady tested positive for the novel coronavirus. Oil prices tumbled about 5%. Shares fell in Paris, Frankfurt, London, and Tokyo. Many markets in Asia have been closed for holidays. U.S. markets reacted negatively to the news that the president tested positive. Key U.S. indices were down about 1% in early trading. U.S. job growth also slowed more than expected in September as the recovery from the COVID-19 slump shifts into lower gear amid diminishing government money and a relentless pandemic, leaving many at risk of becoming permanently unemployed. The Labor Department on Friday said non-farm payrolls increased by 661,000 jobs last month after advancing 1.489 million in August. Economists polled by Reuters News had forecasted about 850,000 jobs, bringing unemployment to a rate of 7.9% from 8.4% in August. Israel is struggling against a virulent second wave of COVID-19 with thousands of new cases diagnosed every day. A key element in the fight to contain the pandemic is contact tracing. In Israel, this is conducted by the Internal Security Service, or the Shin Bet, using methods originally designed for counterterrorism. Linda Gradstein has that story.
More than 600,000 Israelis have been sent to quarantine since the beginning of the coronavirus pandemic after being identified as at risk of contracting COVID-19 by the cell phone tracking program of the Shin Bet and Israel police. The Shin Bet receives names of confirmed COVID-19 patients from the health ministry and then uses a classified database of phone records to find anyone who may have been in contact with the patient for more than 15 minutes. Justine Zwirling and her family have been in quarantine at least four times since the pandemic started.
I came back on almost the last flight from the UK, so I went into isolation then. For 2 weeks, and then my husband came back on the second to last flight from the USA. So then we were in isolation again. Then the whole country went into isolation. And then with the children, we were in isolation a couple of times because we were informed that they had been exposed at school.
Politicians from the government coalition defend the use of the Shin Bet for contact tracing, claiming that the surveillance has detected about 30% of the coronavirus cases in Israel. The Subcommittee for Intelligence of the Knesset, the Israeli parliament, has continually voted to extend the law authorizing the Shin Bet program.
I understand the issue of privacy, but I think people want to know if there is a good chance that they have been next to someone with corona. And if we did a survey asking people if they would want to get an SMS telling them yes, they wouldn't see it as an invasion of privacy. They would say, wow, tell me because I don't want to infect my family.
But some Israeli analysts are concerned about the threat to civil rights and democracy.
Using a secret service in order to conduct contact tracing, which means knowing the location, the history of the phone calls, the history of text messages, the history of web surfing, of all the citizens of Israel who are not suspicious or suspected in anything, though that just might be sick. Doing this is a tremendous violation of human rights in Israel. I would say the most extensive one since the foundation of the country.
Some politicians are also concerned, but acknowledge that most Israelis don't mind the invasion of their privacy.
Israelis, the majority of them, go through an army service. We are living and have been living always under the concept of an existential threat and that we have to pay prices for our security. Israelis were the first, I think, to go through the routine of having their bags checked in the entrance, any entrance to any public space. So I think for Israelis, it's less inconceivable for them that the Secret Service is so deeply involved in their lives.
Well, personally, I don't feel bothered that I'm being tracked because I feel A, we were made aware of the fact that we were being tracked, so it's not some secret or something. And B, you know, it's for our protection and for our awareness.
For months, there have been growing street protests against Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. But while he has been attacked for alleged corruption and abuse of democratic principles, there has been little public opposition to his use of the security services in the fight against the pandemic. For VOA News, Linda Gradstein, Jerusalem.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. 2 years after the brutal murder and dismemberment of Washington Post columnist and U.S. resident Jamal Khashoggi in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, rights advocates and U.S. lawmakers say the fight for justice is not over. VOA's diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports.
On October 2, 2018, Jamal Khashoggi, a Washington Post journalist known for criticizing the rulers of his native Saudi Arabia, went into the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, Turkey. The Central Intelligence Agency says he was assassinated there at the order of Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. 8 people have been convicted of the murder in Saudi Arabia, but no senior Saudi kingdom officials have been held accountable. In his new book, Rage, fellow Washington Post journalist Bob Woodward says he asked President Donald Trump about Khashoggi's murder and if he believed Crown Prince Mohammed is responsible. Woodward says he has tapes of Trump bragging that he saved the prince, saying, "I was able to get Congress to leave him alone." This sends a terrible message of impunity to dictators around the world. Sharif Mansour of the Committee to Protect Journalists told VOA.
One is an admission on tape by President Trump that he personally saved Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman from accountability. And this admission is nothing less than a license to kill for bin Salman to do whatever he wants. And this license needs to be rescinded from U.S. institutions, from the intelligence community here, from U.S. courts, and from U.S. Congress.
President Trump and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo have condemned Khashoggi's murder and stressed that Saudi Arabia is a vital U.S. ally and partner in the fight against terrorism. Some U.S. lawmakers have voiced concern about the Trump administration's lack of action on the murder and other Saudi human rights abuses.
The Saudis, as a consequence of killing Jamal Khashoggi, got a smiling photo op with Secretary Pompeo.
Some have called for an investigation into whether the U.S. government did everything it could to warn Mr. Khashoggi that he was in danger. U.N. Special Rapporteur Agnes Callamard addressed the issue in front of a congressional panel this month.
One area that deserves much more focus is the extent to which the U.S. government knew or should have known that the life of Mr. Khashoggi was at risk and thus should have done more to protect him. The disclosure of U.S. intelligence, including any information related to warning they may have received and to their duty to warn Mr. Khashoggi, I think is very important and part of the search for justice.
The UN Special Rapporteur's report determined the state of Saudi Arabia is responsible for the premeditated execution of Jamal Khashoggi. Cindy Sain, VOA News, Washington.
New European Union sanctions come into effect against Belarus Friday, and the bloc warned Turkey could face the same fate over a maritime dispute during a 2-day summit in Brussels. Lisa Bryant reports on just some of the summit's highlights.
The EU sanctions target some 40 Belarusian officials, but not President Alexander Lukashenko, over flawed August elections and a tough crackdown on subsequent protests. European Union leaders announced the measures following hours of talks in the Belgian capital after managing to overcome opposition from tiny member Cyprus. Nicosia had been holding out in hopes of a similar move against Turkey over disputed oil and gas rights in the eastern Mediterranean. Instead, Europe European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen urged Ankara to pursue dialogue with both Greece and Cyprus in settling what the EU considers a legal infringement in Cypriot waters. In a statement, the bloc warned of consequences otherwise.
In case of such renewed actions by Ankara, the EU will use all its instruments and options available. We have a toolbox that we can apply immediately. But this is not what we want. We want and would prefer to work on a new, long-term EU-Turkey relationship.
A senior Turkish official told news agencies Friday that EU sanctions would make Turkey even more determined to pursue what he described as its territorial rights in the Mediterranean. On Thursday, though, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said he wanted to resolve differences peacefully. EU leaders also called in a statement for an immediate end to fighting between Armenian and Azerbaijani forces over the breakaway region of Nagorno-Karabakh and warned against foreign interference.
300 combattants ont quitté la Syrie pour rejoindre Bakou en passant par Gaza.
French President Emmanuel Macron accused Turkey of sending jihadists from Syria to join the conflict, which he said was unacceptable. Ankara has denied sending mercenaries. The two-day EU summit addressed a raft of other thorny issues, including its relations with China and whether to tie billions of dollars of coronavirus recovery funds to adherence by member states to the rule of law. A first-ever assessment by the European Commission, the bloc's executive arm, found Hungary and Poland in particular faced democratic challenges. Several countries also faced high-level corruption and free press issues, according to the assessment. Separately, the Commission also took legal action against Britain over its decision to override parts of a Brexit agreement. The Commission president is set to hold talks Saturday with British Prime Minister Boris Johnson. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
A United Nations scientific report released in May says that nearly 1 million animal and plant species now face extinction as industrial farming, deforestation, climate change, and other factors tear holes in the Earth's delicate web of ecosystems. Often overlooked are the threats to tiny microorganisms on which all living things ultimately depend on for their basic needs, including breathable air, potable water, and even the manufacture of DNA itself. In part two of our series on biodiversity, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke once more via Skype with research ecologist and professor Sahid Naheem, chair of Columbia's Department of Ecology, Evolution, and Environmental Biology.
When you look at the mass of life on Earth, really only half of it is visible, and those are the plants and the animals, the large things. But in reality, the other half of the mass is actually microbial.
Where are all these microbes?
They're everywhere. They're in our gut, in our soil, they're in our sediments. They're even found on the surfaces of deserts and even on the surfaces of the snow in Antarctica. And the microbes have been on Earth all the way back more than 4 billion years ago. And they actually are responsible for making Earth the livable planet that it is. They're the ones that cycle all the nutrients and process all the energy in ecosystems. They're what makes the air breathable, what makes the water potable, these sort of invisible microbes that are doing this. And so if you were to lose all of the plants and animals, that'd be terrible for us. But Earth would still exist as a livable planet. But if you lost the microbial world, Earth would rapidly start to shut down. Then you'd start to lose the oxygen in the atmosphere. The temperature would skyrocket and reach boiling point. That's how important the microbial world is. And let's consider one of the most essential elements in food is nitrogen. You need nitrogen to make amino acids and proteins. You need nitrogen to make nucleic acids like DNA. The only organisms in all of life on Earth that can do that are the microorganisms.
All this is news to many people.
They're hard to study. You don't see them. So when you're looking at the policy arena, like the Convention on Biological Diversity or the Sustainable Development Goals, they very often don't talk about the microbial world. But now we have all these tools that, for the first time, let us actually see how many microbes are in the soil, how many microbes are in the water, what their diversity is, and what they do.
And I understand that microbes can help prevent disease as well.
A lot of plants and a lot of animals actually derive protection from pathogens by the microbial communities inside them or on their surfaces. These are called microbiomes. Many of them have symbiotic relationships with plants. Look at a field of soybeans. Soybeans actually are as productive as they are and as rich in protein and contain a lot of nitrogen, actually, because they have this mutualistic relationship with microorganisms in their roots. And although you can't see them, if you change the microbiomes, you'll find that the health of plants and animals will decline rapidly.
You and other life scientists have said that modern industrial agricultural methods are one big reason for microbial diversity loss. I know the overuse of chemical fertilizers can be one culprit.
When you actually look at adding a lot of fertilizer to the ground, you'll find that the soil winds up becoming very sort of fragile and frail as the organic black stuff starts to disappear. And that's because you're shifting the microbial community in the soil to one that actually leads to the loss of carbon. So productivity starts to drop, and they don't understand why. They keep adding more fertilizer. It's good to fertilize your crops. It's not good to fertilize your crops with the chemical synthetic fertilizers because they're just way too strong, way too concentrated. They have a big impact on the microbial community.
What other industrial agricultural practices have a significant impact?
Burning. Burning actually also dramatically reduces diversity. The other thing is just tilling the soil. A lot of times if you till the soil improperly, you'll find dramatic declines in biodiversity there as well.
Why don't more people know about this?
They haven't been studied as well as, of course, the elephants and the wildebeest and the pandas. Also, I think when you say the word microbe, very often the first thing that comes to mind is a disease organism or something that, you know, rots our food or something that maybe doesn't matter so much. But I think most everyone who is active in the field understands that it's just as important as the plants and animals.
Sahid Naeem is the chair of Columbia's Department of Ecology, Evolution, and Environmental Biology. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. And until next time, be well, be safe, and have a great weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
As Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has repeatedly made clear, it is a fiction to believe a difference exists between the military and political wings of the terrorist group Hezbollah. This is a Unitarian entity. This is a terrorist organization, he said. It is underwritten by the Islamic Republic of Iran, and it, in its entirety, must be designated as a terrorist entity, and we should make sure that all of those involved and connected to Hezbollah should fall under sanctions. In the past several years, many nations in the international community, including the United Kingdom, Germany, Lithuania, Kosovo, Argentina, Colombia, and Paraguay, have recognized the whole of Hezbollah and not just its military wing as a terrorist organization. Now another European country, Serbia, intends to join the growing list. As part of the historic agreement between Serbia and Kosovo to normalize economic ties, Serbia announced it will designate Hezbollah in its entirety as a terrorist entity. Kosovo did so in June. Unfortunately, other countries, as well as the European Union, have failed to do so, designating only Hezbollah's military wing. The United States welcomed the commitment by Serbia. Secretary of State Pompeo called it another significant step limiting this Iranian-backed terrorist group's ability to operate in Europe. Such limitation on what the U.S. State Department has called Iran's primary terrorist proxy is needed in light, for example, of the 2012 terrorist attack by Hezbollah in Bulgaria, which killed 6 people, and a similar foiled plot in Cyprus the same year. In addition, as the State Department's most recent annual terrorism report noted, as in past years, the Iranian government continued supporting terrorist plots to attack Iranian dissidents in several countries in continental Europe. In recent years, the Netherlands, Belgium, and Albania have all either arrested or expelled Iranian government officials implicated in various terrorist plots in their respective territories. Hailing Serbia's decision, Secretary of State Pompeo said, "There is no doubt that the dominoes are falling on Hezbollah's European operations." The United States continues to call on the European Union and European nations to designate or ban Hezbollah in its entirety, said Secretary Pompeo, and recognize the reality that it is a terrorist organization and branch with no distinctions between its so-called military and political wings. We urge all countries in Europe and elsewhere to take whatever action they can to prevent Hezbollah operatives, recruiters, and financiers from operation on their territories.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.